This is The Conversation. It's episode 215 with Anna Stothart. She is a director in the artist liaison department, specifically at Lehman Maupin Gallery. That's a big gallery in New York City. She's been there a couple of years. We have a really good time talking about the language of art, maybe things that are good to say, some things that are less good to say, and how you talk about art depending on who your audience is. We also talk about her transition from the museum to the gallery world. She was at two institutions prior to being at this commercial gallery. So we talk about that and what she does as a gallery director / curator. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of several shows that she's done with Lehman Maupin, as well as shows she's curated at the ICA in Boston and San Antonio Museum of Art, the other institutions she worked at before Lehman Maupin. You can also find past episodes. I highly recommend the last episode with Jenny Danielson, if you haven't heard that yet. And you can donate to the show. You can find our social media and so on. Before we get to the conversation itself, I'm looking for some help producing the show. I will get more into that in the back end, but I wanted to give you a heads up. Looking for a little help, a couple hours a week. That's all we're talking about. More on the back end. Also on the back end, I am going to talk about the scenario of CB1 Gallery here in Los Angeles, which you may be familiar with. You may not have heard of it. I will bring you up to speed on what's going on with that gallery's demise. It's not pretty. So stay tuned for that. Let's get into the conversation with me and Anna now. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you more on the back end.
Hilarious. So I guest lectured for a class at NYU last night talking about my job. And I said the word practice like four times. And I thought about you every single time I said it. You have created like something in my mind. And I even laughed at one point and everyone's looking at me. They're like, what? I'm like, nothing. Never mind.
That's awesome.
Although I should have said something because they're all aspiring curators. So I could have been like, for the future. Don't ever use this word.
Well, tell you what, Anna. On one hand, I am so grateful that that I've planted a seed that is beginning to sprout. But yes, at the same time, I don't want to be greedy. But next time you talk to curators, tell them, regardless of how many times you say it, say, don't do as I do.
I'll say, in general, because it was a friend of mine, Maleko Magosi, who's an artist, and it's his class. So I've done this twice now. And, you know, I present on my exhibitions, and their goal at the end of the term is to curate their own exhibitions. And so it's, you know, trying to teach them about how to talk to artists, how to do studio visits, you know, when you're working with living artists, how to navigate that. And so, but I did say practice like multiple times. And so going forward, I'm going to start to say, you know, you also, language is important. You have to be careful about these things.
Yeah.
Be considerate of these things. So, but yeah, so it was interesting. But the more I do it, the more I actually learn from them, because it forces you to think about your own work in a very sort of specific and considered way, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also wonder how much being in that environment fosters that kind of language, just because it's so...
It does. Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. I mean, they even said framework like 14 times. I'm like, yeah, you don't even really have to think about what, like, your curatorial vision as like a specific theoretical framework. In fact, I think that we get caught up in like so many problems when we start there, is because while that does exist and while that is often in one's head, like you're looking at something from maybe like aspect of feminism or I don't know, modernism or whatever sort of framework, but I don't think it needs to be discussed. You know, I think you just need to be able to, I don't know, the way that my colleagues have always told me, you have to start with the work and go from there and let it tell you what it needs within the context of either a group exhibition or a solo exhibition or a specific context. And so,
Yeah.
Anyways, it was interesting. So,
yeah, well, you know,
that'll be my new pitch.
Yeah, well, you know, that actually raises a question that I think is interesting to think about. both in regards to museum contexts and galleries for that matter. And it really dovetails pretty much perfectly with your transition from museum world to gallery world. And that is all to say that, you know, museums and academia uses language, and they use a lot of the same language, as you sort of alluded to, fairly specifically, I think. Correct me mm-hmm. if I'm wrong. But it seems like galleries certainly, and we'll get to your gallery in a second, but it's certainly galleries that are very museum-friendly, you know, use that same language as well. There's not too much distinction there, is there?
No, well, I would say that really what you have to look at is where all of the language is coming from. And if you go way back into history, and the first is sort of, you know, art critics, theorists, philosophers, art historians, like all of that language was developed then. And then, you know, as time moves on and as art and sort of different movements develop and as we sort of move through time, you know, certain things become more relevant related to time and situations than others. And so really it's a part of the, I would say, the many problems and complications of art history in general, and who writes art history and who art history is for, and sort of how that was sort of began and how it's currently negotiated. And so all of us come from certain levels of academia. Some people have their master's, some people in graduate school, some people, you know, from fine arts, there are makers, but all of us take these similar classes. And there's always the theoretical class where you're actually asked to read and sort of regurgitate information about, you know, feminism, semiotics, things like that, which is where all of this language generates from. And so then it just sort of filters down through artists and their studios, through art historians, through curators, and becomes part of everyday general practice, I think. And we sort of don't think back to the origin of a lot of that, those terms and languages, and think of how to maybe, I don't know, shift them a little bit, come up with more sort of everyday language, as I like to do. But yeah, so I don't know. I think that's where that comes from.
So when you just used the P word just now, I don't know if you noticed that. You did. You did notice? You said everyday P word. You said everyday P word. It all boils down into everyday P word. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. It's so one. It's, and see, that's the thing, is that it's become such a part of our language, because in school, in, you know, our everyday work, in exhibitions, in everything that we read, these words are sort of slipped in, it, you know, ever so carefully, over and over and over again. And I think that it just becomes normalized. And so we don't really consider what it is they actually mean in relation to the larger context of art making and sharing that in exhibitions and in galleries and museums.
Yeah. I think for me, this is kind of a work in progress as far as, you know, what my take on all this language kind of thing is. But I think, as you were saying what you're saying just now, I think you could describe one of my griefs or beefs is it's one thing to write academically, you know, to pepper your language with all these annoying jargony terms. But once you get into spoken language and conversation, then it's just like, really? You know, can we just like mellow out just a little bit, please? You know, I mean, who are you trying to impress?
I mean, everybody. Everyone. It's so funny. You know, it took me a long time to actually find my own voice when presenting or giving tours or speaking publicly. And I have to say, the reason it was so hard and it took me so long was because I had this assumption that I had to sound and speak a certain way,
right,
with a certain level of academic language. And what that did is it totally handcuffed me. And so every time I would give a talk or a lecture, I was so fixated on the language that I was using that I couldn't just talk about the work or the project.
Right.
You know, it really made it so difficult. So the minute that I shook that off and realize that I'm not academic. I don't come from a traditional background. You know, I took a longer time to get through school. I don't really think in that way, and allowed myself to be sort of, I don't know, more casual in my conversations around art, while still respecting and understanding the historical significance of certain things. Mm-hmm. It totally freed me. And now I enjoy speaking in public and I enjoy talking about these things because I don't feel like, oh God, I didn't say, I don't know, I can't even think of the words right now, but you know, I forgot to mention this, or I didn't mention this. It's like, now I feel like, no, I can just like talk about what I know, what I see, what it makes me think of, and I don't have to fit it into a very specific box.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think when you had all those presumptions about what you needed to include, you know, in your talks, mm-hmm. the language you needed to include, how much of that do you think was specific in terms of the pressure that you were putting on yourself to people that you know, mentors and teachers and whatnot, versus this sort of more presumed kind of, this is how one who is giving a talk, you know, a rigorous talk mm-hmm. needs to speak?
I would say it's presumed, but also, you know, when you're going through graduate school and when you're starting off in institutions and you're watching your mentors give talks and lectures and things like that, and you're watching other colleagues and going to other public conversations and talks, you sort of use those as the marker, the benchmark, right?
Yeah.
You're like, ooh,
yeah.
I wanna do that. Like that's what I gotta get towards. And so you think that means that you have to emulate that. And you know, I was really fortunate in the many mentors and teachers in education that I had, that everyone saw the sort of part of me that wasn't academic and really asked me to foster that, actually. So I had a lot of support. I was very fortunate in that way, all the way through to sort of allow myself to have my own voice. But I think they could all see that I was caught up in this assumption. And I think what it is it's like, I mean, as dumb as this sounds, it's like, which is ironic, it's like thinking like you want to sound smart. And I think that there's this misperception that a certain type of language and a certain type of, I don't know, a certain, like, whatever, a certain type of language, I'll stick with that, is what makes you smart.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing that is actually not in fact true. Like, I forget things all the time. I miss details. I misspeak. My grammar isn't always 100%, as many people can say about me. But, you know, and for a long time, it was very hard for me to not connect that to me not being smart.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, listening
and
to
so
you.
And so that's what I think the problem is, you know?
Yeah. Well, listening to you talk now, in this context, and you know, freed from the shackles of your former preconceived notions of how you were supposed to speak, according to your story, this is how people should talk, right? And I don't know, to what extent this was not you when you were more in the museum world, but this is fine. And in fact, one of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking about the talks that you had given and the evolution of those, you know, the public speaking you, was, you know, what kind of audience are we talking about? I mean, I imagine that the majority of the occasions that you've given these talks, the audience is not a bunch of academics, right? So wouldn't it make more sense to talk in everyday vernacular rather than, you know, the ivory tower? / jargon filled ivory tower.
Yes. No, I think so. And I think that, you know, there is a place for some of that language, but again, it's when it speaks to the work and what the artist is sort of working through. If it's necessary, then yes, it should be used. But, you know, there have been times that I've been at talks and there's like, we're like 10 minutes in and I'm like, I don't even understand what's happening right now. I don't understand what anyone's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand
yeah.
what's point of this is. And so, you know, I have, you know, and for a long time, again, that was like part of my self-consciousness of thinking, well, then I just don't understand. And something that I learned from my many mentors in graduate school, you know, presenting those papers, that's super nerve-wracking because you're presenting to your peers and you want to sound a certain way. And, you know, you feel it's a small group, you feel somewhat in competition. And then, you know, entering into the museum world and wanting to be promoted to be a curator. And so when you're being given opportunities either to present or to publicly speak or to install a small selection of objects, sort of as not tests necessarily, but as opportunities to see how you do in those different scenarios, that there's a lot of pressure on oneself in relation to that as well. But I was fortunate to really have great mentors, like I'm saying, Helen Molesworth, Janelle Porter, in my graduate school, Adriana Zavala, people who actually, I think, emulate what you and I are talking about of how you should speak about work. And while they are all very intelligent and do use a lot of that terminology, they do so in a way that is digestible to a general public. And so, yeah, right. It's like when you're speaking, when you're presenting either an exhibition or a body of work to a group of people, most of those people are not your academic curator peers, informed audience. They're there to learn. And so once you sort of get to that, it really gives you freedom. And it was in my museum years that I did start to get comfortable. It was just the beginning that I really struggled and had a difficult time, you know. But by the time I was in San Antonio and working at the San Antonio Museum of Art, I had completely shaken it and felt totally comfortable talking to the community, mm-hmm. especially since most of them and some of them had actually never even stepped foot in an art museum before. So I was actually having to start with people who are looking at contemporary objects and being like, what is that? Like, you know, I do not in any way understand what I'm looking at. And so, you know, really having to sort of break an object down into its various parts and talk about artists who are living today and the process of them looking at the world and figuring out how to portray that in some sort of physical form.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels to me, and I think about this from time to time, not too much, but you know, when maybe seeing a museum show perhaps, or being aware of, or hearing one of these kinds of conversations, I think about the fact that there's this gap between academic language that goes into museum presentations. You know, even if it's not super jargony, it still sort of has to support art history. You know, that's kind of what the language is, or the thesis is geared towards. And then you have, this is complicated, so I'm not sure how easy this is going to be to say, but you have just the sort of vernacular art making, art conversation, artists, you know, in their worlds, which it's a lot looser, you know, and more casual language. And it's sort of, I guess the museums or the entities that are representing the artists are having to reconcile, or we're having to reconcile even in some cases, you know, the two different languages, the two different sides of the art community.
Right. And I actually think the job, you know, and it's something that interesting that you said is this idea of a thesis. And this is also something that I always struggled with. It felt so firm and so definitive of like, this is my thesis. And these are the things that defend the thesis. And not even just in writing, but in exhibitions as well. And really what I think about and what I sort of came to when I was putting together shows and exhibitions or collections of artists' work, I started to think of them more as proposals or propositions, mm-hmm. or even questions. Like, I don't have in any way any answers. Certainly, I can't say that I do. And so the thing that I love about working in the arts and working with the art world is that, and working with artists, is that I get to think about all of the things that confuse me, that I think are complicated, that upset me, and I get to sort of, I don't know, grapple with them by looking at objects that help me sort of get through them. So if you think about like the environmental crisis, you think about racism, you think about issues of identity, like it is the work that artists are producing that really helps me grapple with that. And so when a group exhibition comes about, in my mind, it's from me seeing a collection of things that are actually helping me get to some sort of potential understanding that I then feel I want to share with the public. Mm. And, you know, and really what I think the job of a curator is to take the academic stuff and to take the sort of like hyper intellectual stuff, and then to take what's happening in the artist's studio and to take the object and find some place in the middle where you can find a sort of a moment of understanding and a moment of that you can say, like, this is what this artist is doing with these objects, with these materials in this moment in time that is very much either directly related to or even just in the lineage of X historical thing. You know, to me, that's the job, is it's taking all of these different things and drawing these threads between them and trying to create something that people can kind of come in and not necessarily giving them answers, but offering them a space of contemplation, of wonder, of curiosity, of discovery. And so that's, I don't know, that might be too complicated, but that's really the way that I have come to think about things. And I think a lot of curators do, actually.
I think it's not complicated at all. It's actually the thing that really struck me about what you're describing is the incredible optimism of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the fact that you actually give art that much credit, that you can use it to cope with these various issues. I think that's definitely what your artists are like. Yeah, you go. But, you know, maybe other people out in the world are, you know, like, yeah, that's not really where I want to go when I want to cope with. But just before you respond to that, what comes to mind for you when you think of a particular issue? Like you described yourself as, you know, when I think of a certain thing that is bothering me, that's a very simple way of putting it, but is disturbing me, you know, and putting together a group of work that addresses that. What comes to mind first when you think of that concept for you?
Well, funny you should ask.
Okay.
There was an exhibition I was working on before I left the museum world, and it was looking actually at the environmental crisis, but, you know, I often try to draw connections to what's also happening in pop culture. Mm-hmm. And so full disclosure, I am a horror movie junkie, so I can't help myself. I watch everything and everything that comes out, even if it's really bad.
Okay.
And so there was a period of time that I saw zombies everywhere in cartoons, on commercials, all this stuff. And I thought, you know, what does this mean? You know, why zombies? Why now? And so I started to do all of this research and looking at the trend of every time there's sort of an influx of zombies in pop culture, it's tied to something that's happening in the world that is messed up, you know, be it, I don't know, some sort of, you know, understanding or concern around consumerism. There was like at the early days, it was about slavery. Then there was something around World War II where there were some zombies that had, you know, were being either through literature or other things. And then so I was, you know, it was around when the film World War Z came out, and I saw that the zombie was no longer this individual decomposing abject body following a person. And, you know, you spend the whole movie running away from them and trying not to be bitten or eaten by them. Mm-hmm. But now it was like these floods of bodies that were decimating entire cities in a matter of moments. And I thought, oh my God, like this is sort of our fear of the environmental crisis. And you see all of these major sort of catastrophic events happening one after another. And this like sort of, you know, you could say low level, but I would even say it's more than that, anxiety around crap, we have really messed up the environment, and we could potentially, likely will be extinct at some point in the distant future. And so I started to think about that, and then I started to read and read Eugene Packer's book, In the Dust of This Planet, where he theorizes that horror allows us to articulate the things that are unthinkable. And so it just sort of took me down a path, and all of that was tied to the type of work that I was finding myself drawn to. Wangechi Mutu, David Altmed, Humababa, all of these artists that were depicting bodies or the environment in very liminal, abject ways that I felt were obviously not, none of them were thinking about zombies, but I felt were sort of in line with what the zombie is currently representing in pop culture, but in the art world. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so I started to think about an exhibition about that. So that's kind of what I mean by that. And whenever I'm trying to sort of grapple with something, I try to make connections in all aspects of the world. Like I don't think that the art world works or exists in a bubble. I mean, I think, unfortunately, sometimes it appears that way. But I think that you can often make links to pop culture, to history, to science, to many other things that are happening around the world. And I really try to do that when I'm thinking about exhibitions, so that it can be more widely understandable, relevant, interesting, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, isn't one of the perennial questions with contemporary art whether it indeed does filter out of that bubble into the greater culture, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly, to take your example with zombie horror films, I was interested in, when you were talking about that, I was interested in thinking about the filmmakers, you know, many of whom are probably not, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Not maybe super great artists, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And yet, you know, is it consciously, or is it just unconscious? Probably a mix of, you know, certainly across the spectrum, in terms of them making these pictures that, as you described, reflect what's going on, you know, with the world. But then to take the artist that you have described as fulfilling your curatorial vision, right, of a certain kind of apocalypse, or, you know, or a zombie world, or whatever, however you want to describe it. You can correct me if you prefer. But how that, you know, certainly the zombie films are out in the popular culture to the extent that they're quote unquote mainstream, right? But then if you can only see, you know, this work at Lehman Maupin or wherever, you know, who's going to go see it? So, and then, you know, that's a whole nother conversation perhaps for another time, but I just did want to point out that was one of the things that came out of what you said.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's where catalogs come into play. That's where touring exhibitions come into play. I think, you know, and when I was working on that show, and, you know, it still sits in my mind very, you know, I think about it a lot and hope it will happen at some point, who knows in what context, but, I think that, you know, part of it is too, and I just wanted to clarify just to make, you know, that when I'm sort of thinking about an issue like this or a topic like this, and I start to think about certain artists within that context, I have many conversations with them about how I would see their work being in conversation with that general idea. Because I never think of it as the artwork fulfilling my thesis. Okay. As I think of it, it actually teasing it out a little bit and actually either problematizing what I'm saying or creating, you know, or I don't know, asking questions, answering questions. But I really, like, I am always very careful in the way that I am discussing how I am presenting works in a space, is that I really try to kind of take myself out of it, because while the ideas do come from me, none of it is original to me. A lot of it comes from my experience in artist studios, you know, when I'm watching TV, going to movies, having conversations with people, reading books. And so really what I do, and, you know, when I was saying, when I put things, you know, thinking about exhibitions and group exhibitions, of it being more of a proposal, like that exhibition would be a proposal. Like, what does all of this mean? I'm not saying that all of these people or all of these films are necessarily 100% saying, shit, you know, the environment, we've totally fucked up the environment and now humans are going to be extinct. And people are saying, like, within our, you know, within the next generation's lifetime and all of this panic. I'm just saying that, is it possible that all of these similar sort of visual iterations of bodies and landscapes, is it possible that they are all coming from a similar type of anxiety? That's kind of, you know, like, that's how I think of it. I don't like things to be so firm and so, I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like to say that things are one specific thing because I actually don't believe in that. I believe that meaning is fluid. I believe that history can be fluid. I believe that, you know, that it's, I believe all, in all of that. And so kind of what you said about optimism is that while an exhibition like that could be very dark, I also included a number of artists who I think are also very optimistic. And so I wanted, you know, it's like offering all of these different sort of perspectives within what I consider this larger anxiety and problem, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. That all makes sense. Just to clarify, though, about the optimism, because I'm not sure if the way that you just described it reflects how I meant it earlier. You know where I'm going with this? What I meant was the way that you were describing artists. Let me go back. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was.
Oh, I remember. You were saying that I was being optimistic about art having as much power as I was saying it did.
And much relevance. Yeah, exactly.
Relevance. Yes. And I think you're right. I think I am optimistic in that way. And like, full disclosure, I grew up with a father who's an artist. My sister's an artist. My grandfather was a framer. All of my babysitters were artists. So I grew up in a world of artists where I have, and I myself am not a maker by any means. I'm terrible, in fact. But I think I did grow up with an optimistic perspective on the power that visual culture has. And I would even put TV, movies, advertising, all of those things in that. I don't really think of art, even though I know that it is at the fine art world and sort of this like bubble. But I, you know, luckily in undergrad, I studied with Barbara Miller, who was an art historian, but she was more visual cultural studies. So I was fortunate in the very beginning to sort of to look at all of these things under the same umbrella. Right. So mm-hmm. We were watching movies and looking at advertisements and watching, you know, commercials and things like that at the same time that we were learning, reading, analyzing art objects as well.
Right. Well, first of all, before I get to your family in just a second, I want to say that when you say, you know, you're not a maker, you've always been horrible at it or something to that effect. I think, and this is really important for people listening, I think curating especially, and some people are bothered by that word, by the way. It doesn't sound like you are, which is good, because that's just that's an ontological thing that, you know, we don't need to get into. But but curating, because I've done a little bit of it myself, is very difficult actually. And to do the sort of organizing and coming up, but whether it's a thesis, as you described, is maybe not quite your thing, or whether it's a question, you know, and asking these big questions like, what is this anxiety? Where is this anxiety coming from? And then starting to sort of build from that. That's, I recognize how hard that is. So when you say you're not a maker, and by the way, at the same time, any time that you self-deprecate or show humility, you've got my vote. You know what I mean? So we don't need another grandstanding curator, that's for sure. I'm sure you know that all too well, right?
Yes, that is true. No, and I think you're right. And anytime you are putting, organizing or placing objects within a space and having to think about how human bodies move through that space and will, or all of the various ways that they can possibly consider every object in relation to the objects around it. You're right. That is very difficult. It takes a lot of time to learn. It takes really great mentors and teachers, of which I had the best.
Yeah. Lucky you.
And it really, you know, and it takes time. And it also takes being able to really stop and look at objects and really spend time with the artists in their studios and really actually have an understanding by spending time in the galleries of how people walk through and experience things. You know, it was something that Helen and Janelle both taught me was sight lines and spacing and pacing and the way that you can, you know, have walls built in large rooms, not as a way for more wall space, but as a way to slow visitors down, because you want them, you know, today we're in a culture of people that absorb information and ingest information at such a clip that it's really hard as a curator to say, no, spend just like a little bit of time in front of these objects, like considering them. You don't even, you know, of course, if people want to read the labels or the wall text, that's great. That gives them more context. But really, like, getting them to slow down and spend time with objects that have been selected and placed for a specific reason within the context of the museum, the show, and all those things. And so I was really fortunate to be taught that at the very beginning of my career as a curator, of how to navigate the complexity of guiding people through space, which is very hard.
Right.
And I've made mistakes. You know, I realize sometimes you do something and you're like, oh, this can be awesome. People are going to love this. It's going to look so good. And, you know, yeah, it's great. And then it happens and you get it up and you have to move things around and it's not quite as perfect as you want it to be. Or, you know, you realize that one placement wasn't quite as effective or people are missing it. You know, it happens. It happens. But you're right. It is very difficult. It is very difficult. It's more, you know, thinking that when I try to paint something, it's embarrassing. But
well, that might be just a question of time, too, right? Just like with the
what's that?
That might just be a question of time. Just like with the curating, you know. I mean,
yeah,
how good are
you're
people's
right.
curatorial
and the decision
efforts
of what
at the beginning?
To prioritize, right?
Yeah. Just quickly regarding putting together a show in a space, as you described, how much of that is a science at this point? I mean, you know, you made it the what I was envisioning as you were describing your mentors and your own experiences, it's almost like, you know, this is the way it needs to be laid out. There's that much clarity to it, but it seems like it would be a much more, you would need to have a team, you know, you need to have a lot of feedback, you know, and so on. Is that the case?
Yeah. And when I worked with Helen and Janelle, you know, I was at the ICA with them for Helen's full tenure and Janelle, her full tenure minus like a year or so, I think. And we really, every time we would be installing a show or even preparing to install a show, you know, there's a lot that goes into it where you work with a preparator on the floor plan and you start with sort of a digital floor plan. And then there's the model, like the scale model, you know, the small thing that you have, like the tiny art objects that you can move around within the space with a preparator, with the artist. That I, of course, would talk through with Janelle and Helen. And then even doing all of that work, going through all of that with the artists, you know, that's like months of work and really feeling like you've hammered out like your sections, you know, which works are going to go in each space. It is honestly, once you are in the physical space with the objects outside of the crate, it is intuition and it is feeling,
right?
Because I don't even know how to explain it. I always tell people it's like something I feel in my stomach. It's like in your gut. It's like you're standing in front of an object and you're like, this just doesn't feel right. I don't know what to say. And so preparators and even at the gallery, our team is getting used to my way of doing things of that, like, can we just move this whole room around just once? And then they move it around. I'm like, nah, that doesn't feel right. Okay, let's move it around again. And, you know, and sometimes I actually go back to the original way, but it's like you need to sort of feel through every possible iteration so that you know with confidence that you've come to the right place. And, of course, you know, a lot of that can be, you know, people could do that forever if they're second guessing. But so, you know, you want to limit that because it's people's time, and, you know, the preparators aren't simply there just to hold things for you and move things around. They have other things to do. So it's necessary to be respectful. But I do think you're right. It's like there is a certain amount of planning. There are sort of intellectual decisions to make in the sense of like, all right, when people walk in, the wall tech should be placed somewhere around here. But really, none of those decisions are final until you're in the space with the objects.
Sure.
And that, and a lot, yeah. And sometimes a lot changes, sometimes little changes. But that is, it's a very, and it also varies on how well you know the space. Like at the ICA, by my last show, I knew the space really well. I knew the team really well. So we were able to move through decisions much quicker. My first group show at the gallery, it was a little bit slower only because I didn't know the space. I hadn't worked with the crew before, and I'd never installed work in the context of a gallery before, which also works at a totally different pace and time. And, you know, museums, you have 3 weeks to install a show. Galleries, it's like 4 days.
Mm. Yeah.
Gave me a tiny heart attack.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we get there in a little bit, but, let's just go through a quick chronology of what got you to being in New York, because you've just been there like for 2 years now, right?
Yeah.
So tick through the museums you worked at, and then up until your current gig.
Okay. It's not a long list, but I worked at the ICM in Boston. I started there when I was in graduate school, because I went to Tufts University. Mm-hmm. And I was there as an intern, actually. And I happened to be there when both Nicholas Baum and Jen Mergel left for other positions. And so they hired me on a contract basis to help sort of shepherd through the shows that were in process at that point that I had been assisting on in an intern basis. And then I was there when Helen Molesworth was hired. And during that time, the director of the museum, Jill Medvedow, her assistant went on maternity leave. So I also filled in as her assistant. And so when Helen came on, I was Helen's assistant and the director's assistant and a curatorial assistant. So I actually, in that first year, which was probably the hardest year of my life, maybe that's exaggerating, but it was very hard. But during that year, I not only was getting to learn about the inner workings of making an exhibition and beginning to work with Helen, but also because of working with the director of the museum, I was getting to learn about the actual functions of a museum and how a museum actually works and runs, and getting to FaceTime with the board members and developing relationships with the board members. So that first year really kind of put me on a trajectory that very sort of easily suited me for a curatorial track at that museum. Mm-hmm. Because I was already sort of getting the larger knowledge and foundation within that institution. And so worked with Helen, and then Janelle was hired. I was promoted to curator, given opportunities there. And then after Helen left, and I knew Janelle, you know, had another year or two there, because that had always kind of been her plan to spend a certain amount of time in Boston and then move. But I then got the job offer. Someone reached out to me to be the curator of modern and contemporary art in San Antonio at the San Antonio Museum of Art. And so I took it, and they really wanted me to come in and help re-energize their program, build the collection, re-engage, engage the contemporary collectors in San Antonio and, you know, around San Antonio, but also the artists, and to bring an international focus to the program. I was only in San Antonio for a year. A lot of people have a lot of opinions about that. There were very specific reasons for that, both personal and professional.
Which you can't talk about, apparently, based on the way that you're rushing through it, right?
What's that?
I said, based on the way you're rushing through it, things that you can't talk about. Is that why you're being so concise?
I mean, I can.
Okay.
I think it was, I think the problem was is that I came from a contemporary institution where I was able to crank out shows and getting to do a number of shows. And in San Antonio, I realized that there wasn't really sort of a strong contemporary art program, meaning, I mean, there was, but what I'm saying is there wasn't a lot of financial support for that. So the big ideas that I had were going to be like 4 or 5 years down the road. And,
right.
And while that's fine, and that's normal often in encyclopedic institutions, of which this was, I realized that I really, the thing that I love most about my job is working with living artists. And I knew that that aspect of the job would drastically slow down and be delayed. I work better quickly because I lose, not that I don't want to say I lose interest, but I kind of lose interest if it's dragged out for too long.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of a curator, you know? So
mm-hmm.
I realized that it wasn't totally the right fit. And then I had some personal things happen in my life all around the same time that a headhunter reached out to me about, just basically asked, would you consider working at a gallery? And I said, well, I'd consider anything. I mean, how can you not in this day and age? So
mm-hmm.
when I found out it was Lehman Maupin, of who I'd worked with on 2 exhibitions while I was at the ICA and had close relationships with people who worked there, including David Maupin, we had developed a sort of social friendship when we would see each other at art fairs or openings or things like that. I thought, well, that's very interesting. And so, in meeting with them and talking about the scope of the job, I really had to consider, because the offer was on the table, what it is that I wanted out of my career. And while it's always been important, for me to be a curator, like I said, it was more important that I work with artists and get to be around art and get to be in a sort of more fast-paced environment. And that's what they were offering me, and to be in New York. And so I took the opportunity and have actually found it to be a really fulfilling job, which, I was hesitant. I wasn't sure if it would be as fulfilling as I was hoping it would be.
Right. So yeah. you were at San Antonio Museum, and you were struggling, like, there's some great things about it, but it's not giving me the, creative opportunities that I would like. And you get approached for this opportunity where you do. That was pretty lucky.
Yeah.
Right.
Sort of, I have to say, yes. And I have to say, it's really weird because every single time I am in, a position where I'm beginning to consider some sort of a move or a change in my life, I'm presented with an opportunity. And I don't like to say lucky, or, I don't necessarily believe like that you put energy out and then good things come back in. But I do think that I have been fortunate in that way. I mean, even with graduate school, because I come from a non-traditional past and I don't have the best track record in academia, especially like in high school and shortly thereafter, I only got into 1 graduate school, so I didn't really have a choice. This is where I'm going. It's not like I was accepted to the 10 best graduate schools and had my pick of the litter and everybody was offering me money. I got denied from every single school. And then the second year I even had to apply again, and then got into Tufts and was like, okay. And then same thing. It was like, I was at the ICA when this opportunity presented itself, and I just sort of fell into the job in a way. Of course, I worked hard and did all of those kinds of things. But,
mm-hmm.
and then the same thing with San Antonio, they approached me. And then when I was in San Antonio, Lehman Maupin approached me through this firm. So it's just sort of happened that way. And I think it does for many people in this industry. I think once you have a certain amount of experience under your belt, I think, it is sort of word of mouth. And, I talk to people at other institutions and other galleries all the time and know when they're looking and, can make recommendations or they'll ask me. It was really odd timing.
I was going to say, if you don't want to use the word lucky, if you have some aversion to that word, it sounds pretty lucky to me. Great timing, I think, is a fair way to put it.
Yeah.
Nesbom?
It was.
Good.
Yeah, it was great timing. And
yeah.
It was a very difficult decision because I really hadn't intended to leave and I felt like I still had more work to do there. But when I kind of weighed the pros and cons,
mm-hmm.
I realized that because many things were happening in my life, that that was a move that I needed to make. And at that time, and of course, you know, I asked, I'm like one of those that like crowdsources answers. Mm-hmm, I asked all of the people that I deeply respect and admire, you know, what their thoughts were, because I, you know, it was a difficult decision to transition from the nonprofit world to the for-profit world. I really didn't know. I'd never worked in a commercial gallery. I'd never lived in New York. And I was nervous that it would be, I was nervous that it, that I wouldn't fit in, if that is such a lame high school way of saying it, but you know what I mean?
That's understandable, going from one world to another.
Yeah.
Never having been there.
I was worried, you know, because there was going to be a sales component to my job. I was worried that I wouldn't, you know, that I wouldn't be able to do that. And, you know, I was, you know, I'm a people pleaser. So I was also worried about managing expectations and making sure that while jumping into the unknown, I was still going to be able to perform the way that they wanted me to, and to succeed with the goals that they had set forth for me.
What is this?
I was nervous about that.
Understandably. What is the sales component, briefly, to your job, would you say?
So I, you know, typically it's, you know, everybody, or, you know, it's like there's different structures in galleries, I've learned, where there's people who do sales, people who are artist liaisons. And at Lehman Maupin, there isn't a distinction. So really, there's an artist liaison and sales team. And while some people work with more artists, some people have other responsibilities. I myself, you know, don't typically work with artists. I do work with a couple now, but I'm, you know, I'm kind of more the museum person. But we all have the opportunity to do sales. And so I would say that rather than someone whose primary focus is to do sales, I do them, but I don't have as much pressure to, you know, to make a certain number of sales each year, to hit a certain number, let's say. So my focus is, when it comes to sales, is I try to place work in museums with trustees of museums and at other high levels. And so really, that's, I don't really think about it as sales. I kind of think about it in the same way that I would have in acquiring work for a museum. I kind of think of it in the opposite of which institution and their collection would benefit from a work by X artist. And then I approach them and I talk to them about it. And often it's people that I've worked with in the past and they're friends, or I know what they would and would not be interested in. And then, you know, we go from there. But so that's the sales component. It's not, there's not a lot of pressure, but I have to say it is very fulfilling to be able to place work in institutions where, you know, the work is not only significant in an artist's sort of larger body of work, but also, and to that artist, but also that the, like, it's going to be on view to the public for hundreds of years. So exciting.
If we're going to be around
I don't know. I find it really fulfilling, actually.
Do you think we're going to be around in hundreds of years?
Stop. Maybe 100 at least.
Okay.
100 years.
Okay. That's thank you. I appreciate a little more realism than that. So if you're speaking of zombies, right? So if you're selling a work of one of your artists to an institution, is the sales price exactly the same as it would be to a private collector?
It depends. It's
give me the range.
Obviously,
give me the range.
There's obviously discounts. You know, discounts usually range, I would say, private collectors maybe around 10-15%, sometimes more, depending on if it's a promised gift to a museum, depending on their relationship to the gallery, depending on all of those kinds of things. You know, or I would say, like, and then museums go up from there. And it's difficult to be specific because it honestly depends on the work. It depends on the institution. It depends on their capacity. But, you know, the thing that's important is that Lehman Maupin in particular, I mean, I know a number of galleries are this way, but the reason that I enjoy working for them and was willing to leave the museum world and work with them, or wanted to leave the museum world to work with them, is that they really do prioritize the artist and prioritize the work and prioritize placement. So they give me a lot of leeway, and the rest of the team too. They give us a lot of leeway to negotiate, to make sure that we're not prohibiting certain significant objects from entering certain collections.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was asking about that price point or sales point, just because I was trying to imagine to what extent you're negotiating, you know. So let's say it's your typical deal, your typical museum or institution client. Maybe it's somebody you know, maybe it's somebody you know from your past years, maybe it's somebody you just is an acquaintance who you know more recently. I'm just imagining what that conversation is like. And if you're doing that as part of your negotiation, or if you're passing that off to somebody more specifically in the sales team to do that part of the negotiation, you know?
No, I do it. Mm-hmm. I do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, at the beginning, it was really hard. I was like, so how does this work?
Right, right.
So
trial
and
by fire.
So luckily, I work with a really great team. And so, you know, I often tag team with people who are more sales focused, or I'll just go to David and Michelle and ask them and say, all right, this, I want to make this happen. Like, how far can I push this number? And, you know, how long can I push? Like, can we do payments? Can we do these kinds of things? And they really, I have to say, there have been almost zero times that they have pushed back and been like, no, sorry. You know, they really have worked with me to figure out how to make things happen. And also the thing that's helpful is that I do understand, I mean, and they do too, of course, but I understand a little bit more of what it means to be in a room presenting a work for acquisition and what you have to have in order to make it happen. And I also often know some of the people that sit on those boards. And so I can help, you know, navigate those things. But it is complicated. You know, museums and the way that the museum budgets and funding and all of that works, it is, you know, I think that often people don't understand that all of the fundraising museums are doing are often, if they don't have endowments, it's just to keep the building open. So you're starting there, right? You're starting with like fundraising every single year just for operating expenses. And that includes salaries and things like that. Then you have to fundraise for exhibitions and for every exhibition. And that's shipping, crating, any sort of storage costs. That's like any sort of wall building, demo, all that stuff. And then you have to fundraise for every single acquisition, the storage of that acquisition, the care of that acquisition, all of the stuff that goes into it. So it's also and understanding that those institutions that don't have those major endowments either do need full gifts, promise gifts, or need our help in being flexible with payment, or you know, flexible with the bottom line in order to make certain things happen. And it's not, you know, but also we have to be considerate of the fact that our goal as a gallery and as representing a certain group of artists is that the sale of these works, a large portion of that money is going to the artist to support and to continue to support their studio. So it's also us knowing that you can only go so far because you don't want to cut into, you know, the money that needs to go to the artist to support what they do every day.
Sure. So you're at this gallery, Lehman Maupin. I called her Lehman before, so apologies for that.
Okay.
It's a really big staff. It's like 40 plus people, looks like total, right? So
yeah.
I just set that up to ask, you know, to what extent are you working in the gallery? You know, how much of that of your job is that time versus being at studio visits and out at institutions and so on?
It totally depends. But I'm mostly in the gallery all the time. I try to work from home every once in a while, like today, Thursdays. But really, you know, it's more about how I sort of best do the things that are under my purview. So I edit everything that is written and comes through the gallery. Sometimes things coming from the studio, sometimes things that, you know, press releases at institutions are working on, artists will ask me to have a look over and edit on their behalf, sometimes things like that. So I do all of the editing. I do some writing. I've really only done it twice. I wrote two essays in my first year for two artists, gallery catalogs, or actually one was an outside catalog and one was a gallery catalog, which was great and fun. And then it sort of depends. The studio visits, I think, you know, with the artists that we represent, it just sort of depends on what their needs are and what they're working on and, you know, when's a good time for me to go and spend time with them. Other artists like Nicolene Thomas, I work with her frequently. So I spend a lot of time in her studio. And especially if, like, if a curator is or a museum is going to visit the studio, I'll often be there just to be support for the artist. So, you know, if the artist needs any backup or I need to answer any questions that would be more from the gallery side, or, you know, if they're talking about a show, I can kind of help. I can help navigate that a little bit more in thinking of the artist's larger schedule and either, you know, guiding conversations or distracting from them. But it's so that I spend a lot of time doing that. And then I still do studio visits with artists that we don't represent, just to think about potential future group shows or to think about, I don't know, the works that artists are making that we represent in relation to this sort of larger, I don't know, larger art world at this moment. And then, of course, thinking of, you know, which artists and which works would be interesting to add to and grow the program. And that is something that I work closely with the rest of the team, and especially David and Rochelle on, is, you know, thinking about that. And one of, you know, two of the recent artists are MacArthur Binion and Cecilia Vicuña, who are having sort of a moment right now. MacArthur was in the Venice Biennale and Cecilia was in Documenta. And they're both a little bit later in their career. Cecilia is 69, MacArthur 72. And Cecilia was something that I worked on, but it happened, I think, in the last year. I can't even remember when we announced now because I've been talking to her for a while, but, you know, things like that. So that's the kind of stuff that I do in addition to being in the gallery, being a museum liaison, talking to curators, informing people about the work. You know, I've installed three group shows at the gallery, one's up right now. And I just kind of, I'm just there if people need any advice on certain situations, especially when navigating the complexities of the nonprofit world. And I also am there to help give the rest of the team the tools to talk about the work. So, you know, I'll give short little talks in front of objects, or I'll, you know, talk about an artist, a sort of larger body of work, and then within this, you know, art historical context, just so that everyone in the gallery, from the communications department to the finance department to the registrars, to the preparators, to the sales team, to the gallery assistants, to the artist liaison, have all of that, those tools and information, so that they feel empowered when talking about the work in their various capacities.
So one of these presentations that you will do about a given work, say, is that something that happens on any given day that you're at the gallery, or is that just like every once in a while?
Like every once in a while, I'm trying to make it more regulated. But recently, Cecilia Vicuña has made, there's a number of paintings from the 1970s that she had had in her studio for a very long time, like the last 20 years. And we just had them stretched and a conservator look at them. They're stunningly beautiful. So I installed them and had the gallery come and we talked about them and they asked questions. I think that because all of us come from different backgrounds, you know, some of these, you know, some of the people in the gallery come from the Christie's program. Some of them grew up in the gallery, started as gallery assistants and learned that way. I came from art history, you know, but then through the museum world. So I think that we all think about and contextualize art in different ways. And so what I do in those moments is really kind of get a sense of, one, what they're interested in, what they know, but also give them what I think is the information that they need in order to, properly present the work or properly talk about the work or properly pitch the work to various journalists. You know, I try to give them those little kind of nuggets of information.
AKA's.
So it's not like I'm giving them like full art history lessons. I try to give context, of course, as well, but
Right. Really
trying to hit on what I think is the most important thing about this artist and their work and what makes each one of these objects incredibly significant in relation to everything else.
Right.
And so that is circumstantial in that, you know, when a new artist comes on, I do that. And I actually, you know, and it's also about time and me learning how to manage my time in an environment that moves at such a speed that I can barely keep up with it. But so, you know, I'm a little behind on some of those things, but really wanting, because, you know, it's like, even though like some people have come from art history backgrounds and some haven't, but everybody is hungry for information. Everybody wants to learn. People don't work in the art world because they just feel like it. That just doesn't exist. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like everybody has some sort of interest or desire to work around art objects and with artists. So for me, it's just a matter of giving them something so they don't feel like they're just sitting in a space and having to read information when it's put together, but that we can actually create multiple sort of forms of information sharing that feels productive and speaks to everybody's sort of various ways of learning. So kind of like a museum in a way, sort of.
Do you ever get tired of doing the same spiel multiple times?
I don't ever do this same spiel every time. That's the mm-hmm. maybe the bad thing about me. I don't know. It's funny, like sometimes I'll say things and people will be like, wait, that was great. What did you just say? I'm like, I don't know what I just said. I don't know what I just said. So I think it's every single time I talk about a work or every single time I talk about a show, I'll obviously hit like similar parts, but I am not good at scripting myself. I am not good at making sure I say the same thing every time. And I think I would get a little bit bored if I did. So, mm-hmm. you know, every time I give a tour of anything in the gallery, I will talk about something. I will focus on a different object each time, probably, and give it more of my attention. Because also it keeps my brain thinking and it keeps me activated. In a way. And so, and it's great because, you know, like last week, a whole group of aspiring artists and art historians from Brandeis with their instructors came and I gave them a tour of the group exhibition and they asked me questions about my job and working in museums and working in the gallery. And then sometimes it'll be a group of museum trustees with the director and the curator. So in a way, the types of things I'm doing are similar to the types of things that I was doing in the museum. It's just the context is different. You know, it's not as formalized. So it's not like it's something that's set up. It's often a museum group walks in and someone calls me from the front desk and says, do you want to come and talk to them? And I come out and say hi and answer questions and do things like that, rather than it being set up in the museum setting.
Right. So how long was it that you were at the ICA, your original job?
I was there from 2009 to 2015, I think.
Okay.
So I was there for a long time.
Yeah, well, I guess so. Is 6 years a long time in a museum?
I mean, yeah, for me.
For you.
Obviously.
Well, yeah, for you, right.
One or the other one.
Well, my point is that 6 years, 7 years with Texas, and then a couple of years. So 7 years essentially, and you're one of the directors of a really big New York gallery. That's a pretty quick arc, I think.
Yeah.
And where are you? Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, and I'm older too. Like it took me a long time to get there. So when I was in graduate school, when I started at the ICA, I was 30. So it's not like I was you know, I'm about to be 40. So really the last 10 years is how I've been, is when I've been developing my career. Before that, it was a very slow and often painful process, mm-hmm. I should say.
Okay. Well, you're still young.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Anytime.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Anna for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that, found it enlightening and whatnot. And I hope indeed, Anna, that a seed has been planted in terms of the word choices that you use and you teach to your constituents, if you will. All right, before we get on to the news about CB1 Gallery here in Los Angeles, as well as my announcement about asking you or anybody you might know who might want to help out on the production end of this show, wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. It has been a while. It has been a while since we've gotten some significant donations to the show, so ringing the bell in hopes that you will come support. And we have I can't sell it yet, but we have a really intriguing upcoming bonus episode. So bonus episodes are a nice little enticement to get you to join as a donator. There are four. There's going to be a fifth one coming out soon. And all you need to do is donate $25 or more one time via PayPal or $5 a month pledge via Patreon. Both of those are linked on the support page of theconversationpod.com. Of course, more is always appreciated if you can afford it, but I understand if your budget's tight. In any case, your financial contributions really do help keep this show going, so thank you very much in advance. You can support the show non-financially as well by leaving a great review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, etc., whatever platform you're using. You can follow the show on social media, at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow on Facebook. And yeah, again, you can leave a great review. That'll help more people find the show. And of course, you can spread the word. Let people know about the show. Thank you very much in advance. So looking for a little assistance, a couple, maybe 1.5 to 3 hours a week. That's all. You don't even have to be in the States, technically. It would probably help if you're in North America, but we can work something out if you're interested in helping and you're outside of North America. Basically, it's assistance producing this show, particularly booking guests, and I'll tell you more about that process if you would like to find out more, or if you know somebody who might be interested, get in touch with me via the website or theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. All right, thank you in advance. So now let's talk about the situation with the gallery CB1. Some news broke earlier this week. Just last weekend, I was at their latest opening. I knew a few people involved with a group show in the smaller space, and then they had a larger solo show in the larger space. I found out as well that this is their last show, which comes as no surprise once you hear the news, if you haven't heard it. So this is from ArtNet News from the 17th. So midweek, here's the title. They should be in jail. Artists accuse dealers at Los Angeles's CB1 Gallery of fraud. I'm just going to give you some highlights, some important points from the piece. In an open letter published on Tuesday, 9 artists claim that the dealer, Clyde Beswick, along with partner Jason Chang, stiffed them repeatedly and engaged in a pattern of, quote, systematic and unfailing, unquote, abuse. Among the letter's signatories are artists Emily Davis Adams, Elliot Green, Amy Yose, and Michael Mancari. And just a week ago, Michael Mancari, the just aforementioned, on Facebook posted a big heading, CB1 Gallery, and then in giant red letters below that, fraud. And I'll give you a little taste of it. CB1 Gallery fraud. Clyde Beswick and Jason Chang, owners of CB1 Gallery, should be in jail. You have sold my work and never paid me. Despite having filed a lawsuit against them, they blatantly have refused and ignored signed contracts and settlement agreements. The lawsuit will continue. You can run, move, or close your business, but I won't stop until I have justice. Adams told ArtNet News that she estimates that Beswick and Chang owe in excess of $90,000 based on her conversations with disgruntled artists who have worked with the gallery. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. According to the lawsuit, Mancari showed his work at CB1 Gallery three times with works priced up to $17,000. Beswick allegedly wrote him a check for less than what he was owed for the sale of some works, and the check bounced. The artist is demanding, quote, exemplary and punitive, unquote, damages of $100,000. So, and then I wanted to mention that something that Brian Boucher, the writer of this piece, wrote, which I think is important. The situation lifts the veil on something of an open secret in the art world. Some dealers float their operations by not paying their artists. And many of those artists, desperate to show their work no matter what, keep quiet so as not to gain a reputation as whistleblowers. Adam says that a number of artists have even, and by the way, this is not to be confused with gallery artist Lisa Adams, it's a different Adams, says that a number of artists have even asked her for an introduction to CB1 Gallery despite the allegations of misconduct. They tell me I'd rather show my work even if I don't get paid, she says. Well, that's a pretty sad statement, isn't it? I certainly know of at least one, probably more, cases of another gallery that screwed its artists out of payment that was owed them after the gallerist sold the works. I'm sure many of you know of similar scenarios, and it's sad, isn't it? Of course, now more than ever, there are more artists than there are slots in galleries, so you know, you kind of have to understand the sentiment of, you know, I just want the opportunity to get shown. I don't care if the work is sold, but you know, that's obviously no excuse for fraud or alleged fraud. Beswick, by the way, in the piece, claims innocence and then ends his statement with, "We truly love the art that we have exhibited and respect the artists. I will not be making any further statement at this time," which really kind of tells you everything, doesn't it? So anyway, that's the situation. Sad. The gallery is now winding itself down. So, you know, if you want to go see their last show. And by the way, they are in a building on South Santa Fe Avenue in the downtown area that was previously occupied by Rosemond Felsen's gallery. Its last incarnation of about three, I think, the longest run, of course, being at Bergamot Station. So she was there in the front of this building for all of about 6 months before she shut down for good. And all I can tell you about that is not a lot of good mojo in that building, clearly. So beware potential new tenants. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening and supporting the show and spreading the word. I'm happy to hear from you if you have any thoughts about the episode or other episodes, or you want to reach out to me, you want to propose a guest, etc. All right, that's enough minutiae for this week. I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thank you for listening, and ciao for now.